You're listening to Dignity and Joy, a podcast from FoodShare. On the pod, we confront the systems of oppression that impact who has access to food and the land it's grown on and who doesn't. Achieving something better will take hard work from all of us and can only be done if we listen closely to the people who are already leading change in the way we think about food. FoodShare's Sheldamar Elliott delves into the connections between food and justice with folks who have their fingers on the pulse and their hands in the soil. Together, they dream in color and consider what it would take to build a just and hopeful city. A city where everyone can feed themselves, their loved ones, and their community with dignity and with joy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Dignity and Joy. This is a different sort of episode from the ones that we usually do. And for folks who've been listening, often you're familiar with a one-on-one interview. But I think this time we wanted the opportunity to bring you into some conversations that FoodShare has hosted recently because we have such a vibrant and committed community so that we get to hear from at events, at town halls, and panel discussions. And it never feels like a dull moment. However, I think this episode is extra fun as we'll get to explore some more of these chats with a special guest. Our guest for today's episode is Hansel Igbawa. And Hansel is a multidisciplinary artist, a filmmaker, community organizer, advocate, and researcher. His work is steeped in storytelling, community building, activism, and social innovation. Hansel explores the realms of the liberative and transformative power of food and nature, the politics of socioeconomic change, deconstruction of colonial and racist powers, and reconnection to indigenous knowledge, rituals, traditions. Hansel is the Right to Food campaign coordinator at FoodShare, where he works to mobilize communities around our human right to food and push our rights to be respected, protected, and realized in the city of Toronto. Welcome, Hansel.
Brap. Thank you. Hey, I'm Hansel Igbawa. My pronouns are he, him, and I am excited to have this conversation today.
Yes, I'm excited to have this conversation with you too. Thank you for bringing all that energy. We need it always. And I think this is a fun one, considering that folks may not know this, but Hansel and I have known each other for quite some time now. And we both met as students at Toronto Metropolitan University. And we just connected over a lot of our shared interests, but specifically around food justice and Black food sovereignty. And in about 2017, 2018, we did some research that allowed us to connect with other Black farmers, academics, scholars, just really incredible community across the city, which at least for me kind of helped me get on this journey to where I am today. So Hansel, it's fun that, you know, who would have thought we'd be doing what we're doing at school?
It's been a while, but it wasn't actually 2017, 2018. It was actually end of 2018, 2019, we did the research. But yeah. It's been a long way. That work exposed us to a lot of the work happening outside of campuses, and now we're doing this every day as work. So it's exciting.
Yes, we are. This is work, right? And outside of work, Hansel and I are also involved with a few different community projects. One of them being the Brampton Youth Farming Collective, where I'm on the steering committee, and Hansel does some coordination there. And we've also been working on a art project. I don't want to give too much away because it's still ongoing, but sort of highlighting and emphasizing the journeys and stories of Black youth in farming and their connection to land. Yeah, that will come out when it comes out.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a labor of love, right?
Mm-hmm. Truly, really and truly a labor of love. And it will come out at the right time, like you said. And we are all going to be happy about it.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. Well, before we get into anything, I want to start by acknowledging that I'm here in Toronto, sacred land that is the traditional territories of the Wendat, Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and the Mississaugas of the Credit, and that this territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenants. At FoodShare, we think it's important to start any conversation on this land by recognizing the many nations of Indigenous peoples who presently live on this land, those who have spent time here, and the ancestors who have hunted and gathered on this land. I also want to acknowledge the many people of African descent who are not settlers, but whose ancestors were forcibly displaced as part of the transatlantic slave trade, brought against their will, and made to work on these lands. At FoodShare, we believe that advancing Indigenous sovereignty is deeply and inextricably linked to Black liberation, and we remain committed to advancing both. So, Hansel was also the MC at FoodShare's recent annual general meeting, where we, instead of having a keynote address by one person, we decided to have a roundtable, which I hosted, which we called Manifesting the Toronto We Want. We had guests from across the city, different parts of community groups and organizations, all sharing really important knowledges about the work that they're undertaking and what the future can entail.
Yeah, I always say this, having conversations like that, I think, one, it's part of my everyday life, but having it be on a stage like that, in a sense, like, I feel like always reinvigorates me, and that's something I want. Like, those conversations are important to keep us going, because the work we're doing is not easy. The work that's happening in the community is not easy, and we will see the type of work that, you know, folks are doing from the conversation we're gonna have today. So it's like, people are doing a lot, and it's always important to acknowledge, to recognize, to talk about it, not just for the sake of talking about it, but really for the supportiveness of it. And we're going to hear from the folks on the supportive partnership platform that FoodShare has today. I'm excited.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm really glad and humbled, honestly, by the fact that I got to sit with these folks. And the FoodShare supportive partnership platform is really a program where we can support community-led food initiatives and help them access different supports that they need to essentially move towards a goal of being self-sufficient and doing their own work. So some of the supports that we offer is providing mentorship, advice, and guidance in problem solving, building capacity through strategic planning, anti-oppressive training. A big bulk of the work is also offering financial management services and support. So kind of tracking expenses and budgets and deadlines and timelines that these folks are on, and ultimately just sharing resources. And we got to hear from really incredible folks, people from Birchmount Community Action Council, Gig Workers United, Thorncliffe Park Urban Farmers, and a few others that we'll get into in this chat. And it's nice, though, because oftentimes I'm working behind the scenes, you know, doing a lot of more admin sort of bookkeeping work. But I thought it was really important and special for us to take a time to highlight them and have a real conversation. So I'm thinking, like, you know, as that panel happens, there is so much to unpack. And really, Manifesting the Toronto We Want was a response to the need for more conversations around actions underway to address the problems in our food system. And as I just alluded to, some of the guests that we had were Laura Hammond from the Birchmount Community Action Council. And some may already recognize her from one of the conversations we had earlier in the podcast, where she shared a lot about her community work in Scarborough and Birchmount community. And Laura, if anybody knows her, is an all-around champion. Not only is she a mother of seven, but she works tirelessly day in, day out as a community collaborator, and is just constantly on the front lines supporting her community and the people she loves and trusts.
I just wanted to make a quick side plug to talk about the fact that, like, people are going to learn a little bit more about Laura as a person and the work she does in that project Sheldon and I were referring to earlier in the podcast.
Mm-hmm. I like that, a little shameless plug. Another, you know, I don't want to take up too much time speaking about all the guests because we'll dive into it later, but we had Liz from Vivimos Juntix, Comimos Juntix, which in Spanish translates to we live together, we eat together. And they're a coordinator and one of the lead researchers on a project called Financial Resistance When Undocumented, which invited undocumented folks to speak about their experience in navigating employment in Ontario. You know, we had Shabina from Seed, Soil, and Spirit School, who was a community herbalist and working to uplift Indigenous systems of medicine and land stewardship. Michelle, so thoughtful, from Thorncliffe Park Urban Farmers, who essentially brought her community together in the Thorncliffe Park neighborhood and is now running two communal vegetable gardens. And we also had Jennifer from Foodstairs United, who is also so busy and does incredible work, but she's a gig worker who's delivering food by bicycle in downtown. She's also the president of Gig Workers United and a worker organizer for Foodstairs, just working to organize around labor protections and workers' rights. So a really, you know, stacked panel that we had. And before we even decided who was going to be talking on the panel, the impetus for that conversation, you know, about manifesting the Toronto we want was really around some of the work that you and your team, Hansel, has been doing regarding Right to Food. Do you mind sharing a bit about that?
Yeah, so the Right to Food campaign launched in the fall of 2021. And the core of the campaign on the side of like pushing the city has been to renew our 21-year-old, 22-year-old food charter that was passed. And when this food charter was passed years ago, it was seen as like something that would transform the landscape of food access and urban agriculture, not only in Toronto, but across Canada and across North America, and like cities would emulate this idea. It was supposed to, by the name of Food Charter, recognize our human right to food and address the issues that were impeding on that, right? Well, it's been how many years later? And what it was not supposed to be, which is a document framed on the wall, it turned out to be a document locked up in the bunkers of City Hall. Mm. Because when we were having conversations with councillors and some city staff, many, many people we met with didn't know that the City of Toronto even had a food charter in the first place. And we were having conversations and saying, like, this food charter, not only is this food charter not necessarily in use, it's also inadequate to address the problems that, like, we've always faced in Toronto and now have been exacerbated during this pandemic that we really are still going through. And that's that's the start of the campaign. And we did a lot of, like, you know, public facing work to get people aware of the fact that we even have a food charter in the first place. And then, like, what next? Like, updating the food charter has kind of been the central focus of our work on the city side. But we've also done a lot of community mobilization around the idea of, like, our human right to food. Mm. One of the things we've done, the town hall, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, but we also recently did our exhibit to engage community. I'll talk a little bit about that later too. But we've done a lot of community mobilization. But starting up the campaign in the fall of 2021, we really wanted the campaign to center community voices, the folks who have always done this work, the folks who have come before us, the folks who continue to fight for the food rights of the community, the folks who continue to dream and work towards food sovereignty. And we had a lot of amazing people, Black and Indigenous folks, on the panel in a town hall style conversation. And that was, you know, that was a great kind of conversation that happened that really, like, guided and led the direction of our work. And I guess, like, some of the major wins we've had so far in the campaign is having a motion being passed last year directing the city staff to work towards, like, updating the food charter in consultation with community. And it's been it's been a year plus, and it's been a year plus and not much has happened, but we have been consistently pushing and pushing for more. And the work is a lot of back and forth, but in all that, I think the community aspect of it, the mobilizing community around this idea and reminding us that, like, it's not even a reminder, but, like, creating the avenues to reaffirm that fundamental right that we have to food is important. So, yeah, I'm going to leave it at that.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. And I know you and your push is not going to stop. So the city's up against a lot if they don't listen. But I know that, I will say for the audience, I think this is also another special episode because we have clips from some of these past events and from the AGM that we'd like to share with you. So you get a sense of some of the things that were talked about. And I know Zakaya Tafari from African Food Basket, who's someone who's leading really important food work in their community, in the Jane and Finch community for African, Caribbean, and Black folks, shared a bit about food sovereignty and his experience, where you can hear that here.
So the Food Basket is an organization that's been around for 25 years, championing food justice for the African, Caribbean, Black community. It was founded by my parents. And being very honest, you know, when they started this organization, I was very naive to the bigger community needs. You know, growing up in a family that did, you know, we garden in our backyard, we were connected to urban farms, we would go strawberry picking, corn picking. I thought these were things that everybody did. But definitely as I got into social work, I realized that not everybody has strong connections to food, and really understanding the importance of championing food justice and having access to cultural food. More specifically around COVID, we launched something called the Black Food Toronto Program, because we knew that with all the lockdowns that were happening, the panic buying that was going on, members of our community were going to suffer. They were going to struggle to find food. They were going to struggle to access healthy food. And especially as the pandemic went on, you know, our seniors, our small families, we created a system through a website called Black Food Toronto, where folks could sign up and access a fresh basket of healthy, culturally sensitive foods. We would incorporate things like avocados, sweet potatoes, ginger, mangoes when possible, giving people healthy food. We also connected with local farmers. So when corn was in season, we'd be providing them with corn. We also run an urban farm up at Black Jane and Steeles at the Black Creek Farm. And we were able to grow things like kale, callaloo, tomatoes, cucumbers, and these are things that we incorporated into our baskets. At the height of what we were doing, we were providing support to over 500 households a week through the direct delivery drop-offs, as well as working with community partners such as CAFCAN, Taibu Community Health Center, and a number of other community partners to make sure people had access to food. As I was able to go on some of these deliveries, you know, it was bittersweet to see people's response to getting a basket that had these kind of healthy food in it, being so thankful and so grateful to be able to have access to food. And, you know, given the Toronto Food Charter, you would think that this would not be an issue, especially in a city like this during this day and age, but it is, and it's a constant ongoing issue.
Yes, it is. Preach, Sakaya. Wow. I can't lie. I could go for an avocado right now, but I think that speaks to the importance of healthy, culturally appropriate food, you know, and his word, sensitive food. And I could imagine during the pandemic like that, like the need for that was just exacerbated tenfold. And also what I hear in what he's saying is like the importance of getting others involved in securing healthy food is also so essential to keeping this work alive. So I know, Hansel, at that town hall that you folks did, you asked people to share their thoughts to a prompt, all right, around imagining a future where we can all access foods in the ways that we want to. And what does it look like? What does it feel like? And I recall the responses were so rich and varied. I remember hearing things like, you know, folks saying reduced their miles that their food has to travel so people can grow their own food on a balcony, on a roof, or in a garden, or teaching people how to harness and collect rainwater, how to collect seeds. Seeds are life. Community kitchens, gardens, food forests, gatherings to eat together at all times of the day. I sign up for that one 100%. But these other ones here too, like having a loving relationship with culturally relevant food and our bodies. And last but not least, land back. And it really struck me in seeing and hearing these responses that what we're working toward when it comes to achieving food justice is ultimately food sovereignty. And that's nothing new. And yet there's something about seeking these old ways of knowing and being, of returning to the way that we've always been growing and preparing food, that feels downright revolutionary. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, before I say what I think about that is I wanted to pause and rewind a little bit back to what Zakaya had said about the work that is happening in African Food Basket. And I think it's important to recognize the scale of what was done. Mm. Like I got one of those boxes every week and I was organizing like we African Food Basket to providing those food boxes for Black students in Toronto. Mm. It started off with providing food for students in TMU, but then we expanded it to like outside of like TMU, Toronto Metro, and to other students. Like they were delivering boxes like every other day, like to so many people. Mm. I know that like even delivering boxes to just the number of people on the list of people that we provide the boxes to was already so much people, let alone like how many different community organizations they were working alongside with to provide food boxes for folks during the pandemic. I think like it is so important because like when all else fails, like who is there? It's like it's the folks who have been in the community, is the organizations, is the organizing that has always been present in community that shows up for people. So I think it's extremely important for us to recognize that and the scale of that and not diminish like that, because it is big, it is important, and it's very relevant.
Talk about it. It is necessary.
And necessary. Come on.
Yes.
But yeah, like the idea of returning, I think part of my life ethos is the idea of returning to indigenous knowledge from around the world. Like I'm indigenous to somewhere, like I'm from Benin, like it's returned to the knowledge that like my people have, and like return to the knowledge that is indigenous to this place, return to like we can't, I believe like we can't really make any progress if we don't return to that, because like when you look at like a lot of indigenous teachings around the world, there's a deep connection, respect for the world around us, the trees, the plants, the bugs, like the little things and the big things, the water and the air and everything that's around us. And like if we are not paying attention to that, if we're not respecting that, like where are we really going? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for us to get those opportunities for us to share the wisdom, to share the value of that idea of returning, and not just as an idea, but like the practice of returning and the ways in which we can return in our everyday life.
I agree wholeheartedly. And yeah, I think it's an extra hurdle for some of us, or a lot of us who are displaced peoples, and like returning to land might look different, but we need to start somewhere. And I know that some of the conversation that happened on the panel, I asked the panelists, what ways do they see that returning happening in their own lives? And a lot of the conversation was about how we share and value wisdom, sort of what you're just talking about now, like how do we reclaim those knowings and those knowledges across generations. And I think Shabina had something really important to say to that.
The wisdom we hold is embedded into that, and in a lot of ways seen as like auntie knowledge or like, you know, like grandma knowledge. And I think sometimes undervalued in that sense. And, you know, I think there is this like returning and realizing that, you know, as systems, Western systems catch up to Indigenous knowledge, that there's so much value in it and there's so much depth to it. So for me, that is the returning, the affirmation of our knowledge and knowledge systems. And it's so beautiful to see. You know, we host a lot of different students from backgrounds, like primarily from Black, Indigenous and racialized communities. And just the process of affirmation is an absolutely beautiful full circle experience for so many of our students. So that's definitely how I see that.
Yeah, for folks who may not know, Shabina is a community herbalist and co-director of Seed Soil Spirit, a grassroots organization run and operated primarily for Black, Indigenous, and racialized communities, offering cross-cultural, self-determined, and decolonial approaches to land-based education. And I think what she says there is so poignant, and it actually quite nicely links with what Laura has to say around the value of intergenerational knowledge sharing.
Having our elders working hand in hand with our youth and, you know, just providing them with that context and knowledge. Because if you didn't grow up in a back home, then, you know, there's a lot of disconnect to what our food systems were, right? You may hear about it, but what does it mean in practice? And, you know, just to hear some of the things that our young people are sharing about their gratefulness of the learnings that are, you know, being shared with them, it's really great. But most importantly, I would say, when it comes to this whole piece of like land stewardship and not actually having access to land that you can pass down as a legacy, I feel like that's a huge hindrance, right? That's one thing to get things going, but when you're looking at sustainability, you're always still asking for permission without having that regard. So we're really looking for a way for us to work collaboratively to ensure that we can hone in on what that means for legacy building, for sustainability. Because for me, I come from a household where I still hear the stories of the ackee tree in the front yard and all of the loveliness of having food right at your fingertips. Although in the back of their mind, they also thought that they were living somewhat of an impoverished life, and that, you know, the golden light would be migrating to Canada. And now coming into the knowledge and the time that, you know, health is wealth, I think it's really important for us to secure spaces where not just community can own, but culturally specific relevant collaborations to ensure that, you know, our types of foods are grown to nourish our bodies.
Man, I want an ackee tree.
I really, this really warms my heart. And it reminds me of the fact that a mutual friend that we have, MK, and they were interviewed for the documentary that we were working on, Future Farmers. I'm just going to say that. Having conversation, I remember the first summer growing food and how they talked about connecting with a lot of like elderly Black folks on the internet, on Facebook's groups, and just how loving the space was and how, you know, they were so willing to share with them. And like people were just sharing the food, and it was like an intergenerational space, and like people who had like knowledge from growing were teaching other people, and like it was just such a beautiful thing. And it even reminds me of me also starting to grow on my balcony, and like I'm having all these conversations with my mom, and then learning that my mom like knows so much about like growing food and farming and whatnot, and I just think it's so beautiful. Like, it makes me, like, I'm cheesing right now. Like, I'm smiling. It makes me so happy. I mean, it warms my heart to see that, because we don't get enough of that intergenerational spaces in the work we do. But yeah, I love it.
I couldn't agree more. Again, Laura is holding her seventh baby and is just preaching facts and knowledge. And I can't get enough of that. But I think to what you're saying there too, Hansel, like for me to relate, I also got into growing food a few years ago. And funny enough, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother when I was a child in her garden. And it's funny how it sort of jumped a generation. Like my mom was never really interested in growing, but is like a wicked cook, like top notch. But once I started to get into growing, now she's learning from me. And it's almost like a full circle effect of like, you know, this intergenerational knowledge sharing, and it could go both ways.
Exactly.
Right? That's a really exciting thing too. It's not always like top down or top up, whatever you want to call it, but it really comes from a place of love and community and spirit and all of these things that we love to talk about. So yeah, I love that. And just even talking about intergenerational opportunities, it brings us right back to what Zakai was saying earlier around inheriting leadership of African Food Basket from his parents. Or me hearing from Jesse, one of the community market coordinators Foodshare works with, who spoke recently at the International Public Markets Conference on the ways she's seeing youth showing up for elders at the weekly produce market she organizes in Scarborough.
If we could reach out to those centers or to those institutions that are around us, be it churches, schools, community centers, and get those able bodies in our buildings, once you engage with them, then they fall in love with you and they look forward to seeing you. So it's just that initial pearl of them facing the reality, I can't do it anymore. So I started, you know, I did my joke thing about fruits, but I also started in my building saying, oh, look for Bill. He's the old guy with the ball cap. And then everybody's like, Bill, the ball cap, the old guy. Well, we're all old guys. This is an acceptance, a beginning of an acceptance that we have our limitations. And if we can get them to accept that in a nice way, then now I know that my people are really open to getting people helping them. Where the first few markets, no, I can carry it. And you'd see them struggle still up an elevator, right? Because now it was even less of a distance, so they wanted to prove themselves. Seniors always have to prove themselves to everybody, right? To their families, because the young people are so much more competent than we are. So we're trying to show them that we are competent too. But you know, if you approach it in a different manner, I think that we could find solutions, but I think it's local. It's very local. It needs to come from the students and the people around us, because that is our community, those people.
It's beautiful to see, you know, young people at a market like this who are not really interested in food or groceries and whatnot still come up and support elders who are shopping from the market and just bringing up their groceries or picking out their selection. It's real wholesome and like speaks to what we're talking about.
For sure. I think there's always magic when the younger folks and the older folks meet. There's always, yeah, there's always magic because there's an exchange that happens. And to what you said earlier, like the exchange doesn't go one way, you know, it doesn't go from like the older to the younger, but it goes both ways. And the bonds and the relationships that are formed from that are so important.
Honestly, hearing stories like this can be so heartening, but I feel like it also makes you realize that it feels special because it feels rare. It's almost like we've lost a lot of this interconnectedness or a sense of like we all depend on each other. And we really don't have to look far to see who's doing the hardest work, paid but also unpaid, of growing food, feeding communities, and addressing food insecurity. And whether that's happening in community or, you know, elsewhere, I think Liz brought up a really important point in terms of what that work really looks like.
It should also be said which land is being used for cultivation, where the land was taken, where it was stolen often, but also to talk about who are the bodies that are working those farms, right? Who are the migrant workers who are growing your food and feeding farmers? Because I know that the Weston family is not out in the fields with mm-hmm. the bad air quality out there. They're not the ones who are laboring. It's migrant workers, it's racialized folks who are doing the really hard work. And I think that talking about those topics and bringing them to discourse or mainstream discourse or talks with your family, as in saying, it's not Canadian farmers, it's people who are being taken advantage of, who often become undocumented, who are in risk of deportation because if their employer doesn't like the way that they're fighting for basic human rights, they could be sent back to their home countries, which is really, really sad. But I also wanted to share this idea that BJCJ asked, is that we are not going to ask the government to do things for us. We are going to organize and create these safe spaces for us because we know what we need. We know the kind of spaces we need. And to have those connections with not only undocumented folks, but with other migrant-led groups, with other grassroots organizations, with other Indigenous folks who are from this territory or from other territories around the world is so meaningful mm-hmm. because this method of knowledge sharing is what is going to get us through, is what is going to be revolutionary. Building relationships with the land and with the folks that you're living with is revolutionary in itself because it brings you out of isolation and it tells you that you belong, you know. And migratory status should not be based on a document, but in the relationships that you have with the people who you live with. So I think that's my thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you for those thoughts, Liz. The Weston family is not out there. And for folks who are not familiar with the Weston family, Galen Weston Jr. is the president of Loblaws, and we all know how much money Loblaws made during the pandemic as we were all struggling with inflation and rising costs of food. So yeah, get him out there.
His pockets are getting inflated. We were struggling with inflation.
It's true though.
They're not out in the fields. It's like they're not out in the fields. And I think to put context to what Liz is saying a little bit more around migrant workers, it's like, you know, it's not called the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. And it was actually started in 1966. And it was between the government of Canada and Jamaica bringing Black folks to work on the fields in terrible working conditions, asterisk terrible working conditions, and equally terrible pay. And the culture of that has just continued till today. The name has changed, like, I don't know, maybe twice since 1966. And they're still doing the same thing. And they've just expanded it to other parts of the Caribbean, Mexico, and like, I think parts of East Asia, specifically the Philippines, I know. Yeah. And it is really like a lot of people have referred to it and people who are migrant workers themselves as modern slavery, because like folks are working on the field. They're using sprayers, pesticides, and whatnot without protective gear. They're being exposed to so much harm. They're getting sick. People are dying. And there's no care there at all. So it's, I think it's so important to pull that into the conversation when we talk about food, because like Liz said, who's speaking of food? Like who, Canadian farmers, like, are the Canadian farmers on the farm speaking of food? Like who really is doing the growing, I think is important. And that collectivism of having like a collective knowledge around the conditions that surround our food system is so important.
Absolutely. And I think it just continues to shine a light on how exploitative this entire food system really is from every point of view. And thank you for adding that context, Hanso. I will throw out a resource for folks who are listening and you may want to learn more. There's a really important documentary called Migrant Dreams. It was directed by Min Suk Lee. It speaks all about a lot of these folks who are coming over from Jamaica, Mexico, and the Philippines, and sort of following them in their journey and their experience here, specifically in Leamington, Ontario, because yeah, that is still ongoing and the government needs to do more about it. But yeah, there are really great groups and supports trying to assist these folks as they try to make their way. You know, really and truly, Hanso, like this, it really makes me think about how we're getting farther and farther away from our food and quite frankly, our humanity. You know, we've traded so much in exchange for convenience, capitalism, and it feels to me like the main thing that we're really losing is connection. And I feel like in any conversation about the ways things need to change, need to center the folks who have been most marginalized. But I continue to go between optimism and pessimism about our ability to revalue the knowledge and the labor of our food workers from all systems, you know, whether they are migrant farmers to delivery folks to cooks, all of these folks are having different experiences at different parts of the food system. And in many ways, I feel like we've collectively lost a lot of our humanity. And, you know, it's funny. There was a video that I watched on YouTube, which sort of acted like the catalyst for the theme of the AGM. And I'll paraphrase the clip a little bit just so we don't have to spend too much time on it. But there's this random tech bro.
Generic random tech bro.
Very generic random tech bro. He was talking about his entrepreneurship and his coffee company and all these things. And in his talk about branding and marketing, he said something along the lines of, humans are loyal to convenience. And it's strange to me, honestly, because I watched the whole video and regardless of whatever else I watched, that point like stuck with me for so long. And it's like my brain was stuck on him saying humans are loyal to convenience just because of the conviction in his voice, as if it's something that he knew to be true. And it kind of sparked something unsettling in my mind, you know, despite, again, what the conversation was actually about. And that's sort of what came about for the theme this year, you know, manifesting the Toronto we want around convenience. So, you know, we see this today, like you can get your fridge fully stocked without seeing a face. Like that kind of freaks me out. I know you can get food delivered to your door, but there's services that they will come in, fill up your fridge, all of that kind of stuff.
And you didn't see them?
You don't see them. They'll just come right into your door.
So what are ghost deliverers?
You must have some real trust if you're keeping your door unlocked for just anybody to come in. And honestly, like, I don't know. I would never do this because I know what my fridge looks like and I need it to be organized. But some people are comfortable with this. And I think, again, it speaks to this idea that like we don't need to be interacting with people these days to get the needs that we want or the food or whatever it is, which is really scary. And, you know, as we're prioritizing convenience and ignoring long-held knowledge of like connection and spirit and land and all these things, where does this take us? And like, what are we really moving away from? And I feel like Jennifer on the panel spoke to this idea of collective power really well.
Trying to make enough money on an app, you know, is very isolating. And a big part of the narrative that apps have sold, both to customers, to workers, to members of government, is that nobody really needs to be connected with anybody. We don't really need each other. You know, if you order food, don't think about the people who made the food. don't think about the people who brought you the food. You just order it on an app. And, you know, here in Toronto, our people are organizing to unionize and pushing back against one of the biggest international corporations in the world, trying to lobby the government for aggressive labor reform. But we're also envisioning a future that looks different than the way things look now and the way they looked in the past. A future where we, the people who do the work, own the means of our labor through a worker cooperative business, where we have the ability to, you know, this industry, I think, is meaningful and provides value to many people in our community. It is also techno-feudalism, and we have the ability to challenge, to undermine and insert ourselves as the workers in that industry and begin to change the terms of how it functions. And all of that exists because we come together with each other. We build community, we organize, we talk with each other, and we challenge long-held beliefs and trade them for understandings and embracing ideas like collective power and supermajority support from the people who do the work or the people who experience the thing which must change. And so that's, I see us coming to each other, which I think is really necessary.
Yeah, she said that so well.
Yeah.
This techno-feudalism, this is something I gotta learn more about.
Yeah. I feel like I think this is important to say very often, because many people find it difficult to think outside of the construct of like white supremacy and capitalism, the society that's been created from those foundations, which is what we're living in globally, honestly speaking, to different degrees in different parts of the world. But many people find it difficult to think outside of that. And we need to start having more conversations of like, how can we assert ourselves? How can we assert indigenous knowledge of being and knowing of what's around us and creation and all of that? Like, how can we reassert ourselves? How can we reassert this knowledge that centers us and not profits and not money? She made a mention to a cooperative business model where the workers are the owners and the work is done for the benefit of the collective and not profits for a few. I think really highlighting things like that is so important, because like, a lot of us need something to help us go along in imagining of ways that we can exist outside of like what we're already existing. We don't have to be workers working for the profit to line the pockets of a few people when we could be working for ourselves. You know, like, why aren't we working for ourselves?
Right. It is like a deep, deep condition that takes a lot of work to like, I think unlearn is a nice way to put it. Like, we really, there's a lot of work to really tease out all of those ways of learning that we've, you know, been conditioned to understand.
Unlearn is an understatement, honestly.
It is. It really is. Because like, yeah, you can try to remove yourself from like the value of materialism and wealth, et cetera. But how do you reconnect, as you were saying, to like, you know, ourselves, our, you know, our inner world, our spirit. I keep saying spirit, but like land and community, like that's where the real work happens. And they don't make it easy. They definitely don't make it easy.
They don't.
I think Jennifer put that so well, but you know, Michelle also brings up a really good point around newcomers coming into a city like Toronto who are feeling lonely, isolated, and a sense of despair.
Like a lot of people in my neighborhood, you know, I also feel that sense of hopeless, you know, a lot of us economically, we're just struggling. And again, like our society has created this system for individualism. And you quite often hear, you know, especially newcomers are very lonely, you know, there's a lot of isolation. And when there's such despair between our society, it's really hard to find ways to change and to feel connected to each other, right? And then when we have a government that feels that is not connected to us, you feel like, where are you gonna go? you know. So on a larger scale, like the reality is, like, it is super challenging to create large scale change, you know, from the bottom up. And then on the other flip side, like, we have a generation of farmers. We have more farmers that are over the age of 65 that are retiring compared to farmers under the age of 45. So it's, in a way, it's a dying industry. And, you know, we have, you know, developers wanting to grow onto their, you know, on their farmland. And these farmers are also inheriting like massive of acres of land that they can't manage. So we're at a point where, like, realistically, AI is going to be farming for our commercial farmers, you know. So I think it's very difficult to create change. And, you know, you mentioned our terrible election, but the problem is, like, leadership is essential.
Yes, it is. And I think that's such a timely thing to say while Toronto is dealing with the real refugee crisis in terms of displacement and housing.
Yeah, the federal government literally has Black people who are seeking asylum on the streets of Toronto. Like, let that sit.
let that sit, yeah, please.
It's like, and oftentimes, like, this is a conversation that's had so many, a lot, like, Canada probably has the best PR of all the Western countries. Like, their PR is top notch because this country is always seen as, like, progressive, da da da, and, like, everyone is welcome. Like, take care of newcomers and whatnot. But here we are going through the same things. And I think what's happening right now with refugees being on the streets is so important to recognize. Because that same Canada, and I think it's important, attaching it to what Michelle had said, is, like, there's an aging population that's dying out. The people them are dying out. And Canada is dependent on immigration to, quote-unquote, fuel its economy. You do all the things to attract people. I mean, one, you're stealing from them. There's so much to talk about. Canadian mining companies on the African continent.
Ooh.
You're doing all this to these people coming here seeking asylum, and you have a hand in why they're here, mm-hmm. a huge hand in so many different aspects. And this is how they get treated when they get here, mm-hmm. and it just goes to again, like, even going back to how migrant workers are treated, how, like, Black and Indigenous folks are treated in this country. Like, it shows. Like, it shows. So anytime we talk about government, let's always remember that's they.
It's he's hot over here, folks. He's hot. But this is real, right? Like, this is so real. Like, we don't, even before we had asylum seekers coming here, like, Black and Indigenous folks are experiencing disproportionate rates of food insecurity, housing insecurity, job insecurity, etc. And the Canadian government is to blame for all of this. And it's part of this fragmented, sort of fractured society that we live in, that is, again, foundation is colonial, white supremacy, capitalism, and trying to make a living and surviving in this country. It ain't easy, to say the least. And I think Lori, from the town hall that you had, Hansel, has something to say about this.
I think it comes down to, like, what does reconciliation look like when it comes to food sovereignty and food security? You know, reconciliation is a big word right now. It's a bit of a buzzword, I think, that we're seeing across Canada, in, you know, cities and towns, and how people can do it. And it isn't just about wearing an orange shirt. You know, it's not about going out and making sure your kids all have orange shirts on Orange Shirt Day. It isn't about making sure that, you know, you're just saying that you're, you know, thinking about reconciliation. There's ways that it really is impactful. And I think one of the big things to think about with Indigenous people and food sovereignty is that us being able to control our own nutrition and our own, you know, like just our own access to food and our own access to wellness in our community allows us to continue that role that we have as stewards of the land, right? And making sure that the land is taken care of and that it's all interconnected. So, you know, I think one of the things is that we're seeing is that in our community, we have a lot of focus on wellness from social service agencies and, you know, support networks and that. But what we also see is a pretty fragmented and at times like piecemeal system of how to access food. A lot of different organizations offer food bank and, you know, food support, but it really is coming from a lot of places like Second Harvest and, you know, Daily Bread and donations. And it often can be that dented can approach of, you know, out of the kindness of my heart, we're donating this and it's expired food. And it isn't really allowing for that opportunity to be on the land and grow the food and understand where the food comes from. Like, we have opportunities to have gardens that exist, and we definitely do have some really interesting Indigenous garden projects that are happening in Toronto, and, you know, food being grown and sourced that way and some land-based stuff. But I think it's that collective approach as a community together. And within Dashmawan, like, what we've done is we've done a lot of harvesting and a lot of foraging on the land and brought that back to the, you know, elders and heard their wonderful stories. We had an opportunity where we made lilac cake and, you know, harvested lilacs right from the trees. And the elders talked about it being something that they remembered as eating when they were children in the residential schools because they didn't have access to sweet stuff. And they would, you know, just suck on the lilacs to get that essence and that fruit, that sweet flavor. So we made cake for them with lilacs baked into it. And, you know, it really was a nice memory that they shared during a time of immense sadness. I think the other thing is that we're dealing with so many different issues within our community that nutrition is the center of, right? Like, we've had to deal with poor nutrition from lack of access to good land to grow things on. We've had, you know, issues with residential schools, Indian hospitals. Nutrition has been used and food has been a weapon that's been used against us. And I think the city, you know, in their big movement to look at reconciliation, often ignores the idea of what does food and food security look like in the middle of all that? And how do we address that in a larger way than just putting a word like reconciliation in something like a food charter or a food plan?
It's wild, honestly. Like, I'm thinking, first off, if you should know already that food is political, but if you've gotten this far to the episode, mm-hmm. You're still wondering, food is absolutely political. But it's really just, again, sinking in this idea of like connection. And connection to everything is really what is missing. And as we dream of a new future, and going back to the theme for the AGM, like manifesting a Toronto that we want, we have to figure that out. We got to explore that. And I know Toronto has a new mayor. Shout out to Olivia Chow. She won that. And I know there's a lot of folks feeling a renewed sense of hope. But, you know, I'll throw this back to you, Hansel. Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful with this? You take the words.
I'm hopeful in the ways that of my connection to my ancestors and to all the fighters that have gone before me and all the people who have done the type of work that I do and I want to do. I'm hopeful in that sense because you can never take that away from me. Am I hopeful for what the government can do?
If only you could see.
You want to answer that question? like blank. You can feel in the space. Yeah, I don't know. Like, there's my answer.
it's like a Mad Libs game. I got a few words. I'm trying to fill in the blank. Well, I guess thinking about your right to food work, and do you feel like any of that will change with a new mayor, or are you hopeful for more openness in that sense?
In kind of continuing what I just said earlier, community work will always happen. Community work will always exist. And I love that, like, a lot of people made mention to this on the panel that happened in the AGM and also the town hall. And while Laurie's talking about the work that you do, community will always fend for itself and build. And it's even connected to the idea of, like, when we start talking about dreaming, like, we're not dreaming of, like, a distant future. We're dreaming of things that are already happening. Like, these things are not out of reach. Like, these things are very much connected to ancestral knowledge. These things are connected to the possibilities that are already happening within community. Like, these are not far fetched. Like, they're right beside us. They're around us. They're, like, screaming at us. They're calling on to us. So it's like, I'm forever hopeful for that. I'm forever hopeful that, like, we will continue to move. We will continue to resist. We'll continue to move. We'll continue to create. And that's where my hope lies. That's where my heart lies. And that's where my work lies. And the rest of the people can, like, we're still going to push, you know, like, and in relation to my work here at Future as the Right to Food campaign coordinator, it's like, we will still continue to, it's my job. So I have to do it. I guess we will continue to push the city, because if we're being forced to live within this, like, constructed government that was constructed again on those foundations of white supremacy, capitalism, anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, mm-hmm. if we're being coerced, which we are, to live under these conditions, then you bet we're going to continue to cause ruckus. Like, we're not going to stop talking about it. We're not going to stop asking you to do better. We're not going to stop disrupting. We're not going to stop not conforming. We're not going to conform to what you believe is right or how things should be. So that's the answer to that question.
That's a great answer. Thank you for that. The movers and the shakers. Really, though, I appreciate that, because I can understand where folks are coming from with seeing a new mayor and hoping for more progressive approaches to policy and legislation. But ultimately, the system's the same. And I think keeping the center on community, as you just said, is really the focus here. And by supporting community who knows what needs to be done for them, that's how the real work happens. And I know, Hansel, in a lot of the work that you're doing with Right to Food and the advocacy team, there's a role of creativity in arts. And there's this new term that I've heard you say recently of, like, artivism. Can you maybe just share a little bit about that, like, how that's showing up in your advocacy?
So artivism is not a new term, but
for me it is.
It's not popular. Yeah. It's just referring to the role of art in activism work and how art has been used in many liberation movements and fights. And it's especially as a Black person, and in a lot of Black movements, art has been an integral part of how we organize, how we move, how we push, how we move. Like, art is just, like, fundamentally part of that. And I think art is also such an accessible way for folks who are usually not part of conversations that we have around, like, food access, food sovereignty. Like, usually it's only, like, people who are in, like, you know, the immediate organizing space or in, like, political spaces or academic spaces that are usually engaged in this conversation. And we oftentimes use all the lingo and the jargon and whatnot. But art is just art. It is what it is. And, like, people can engage with it. People can be a part of that conversation without being an artist, without having to know all the lingo and the jargons that come with certain spaces. So yeah, like, that's
it. That's the stuff. No, I love that. And, you know, to me, yeah, art in my mind has always been a way to like imagine alternative futures and, like, just dream, essentially. Like, dream of what is possible, what we don't see. And I know you folks did an exhibit called Realized Reimagined.
Yes. So last year, my coworker and I organized the Realized Reimagined. And of course, all the team members in the comms team and everybody that worked towards that. And it was, we commissioned three artists in the city of Toronto to create original works around the prompt of, like, you know, if we achieved a city where our rights are being respected and whatnot, what would it look like for you as an individual, for your family, for your friends, loved ones, your community? And those artists created each one original work around that. And we exhibited that at Flemo Farm alongside photos that have been taken by a photographer of different, like, some of the growing programs that FoodShare is involved in around the city. And it was really a beautiful thing because we had a couple of people registered to the event, right? But, like, most of the people who attended that event were just walking by. Mm. It was a lot of people in the community who saw the work on the fence and were like, oh my God, what's that? Some of them were coming to give their organic compost for the organic compost program that happens there. And they're like, oh, this is beautiful. People are just walking by, people driving by, and they come in. And that's the majority of people who are present at that event. So, like, art is such a beautiful way. And also we had, like, a canvas on the floor, actually multiple, and the kids present too, where, like, they were really going all out. Mm-hmm. They were painting and drawing, and it's such a beautiful way to engage everybody, elders, younger folks, youth, adults, everybody in that conversation of, like, what are we collectively dreaming about? And something we had was a response board where we had the prompts on those boards, and people could write on, like, sticky notes and, like, paste that on. I think things like that are beautiful because we can then see, like, what the collective dream of the community is. We oftentimes think that we're alone in our thoughts and our dreams and aspirations for what our world should look like. But the honest truth is that, like, if you're thinking it, many people are. And it's like, how do we get that collected? Art is a beautiful way to bring that together.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I actually really, really love that project, and I wish I was there to see it. But as you're explaining it to me, I'm taking in that, like, that event alone touched on a lot of the things that we've been talking about throughout this conversation. Like, you had art, which allowed folks to dream and, like, imagine, that connection piece with community of people of all ages and backgrounds, whomever. But I think also the solidarity piece of, like, understanding that communities working together and, like, Black, Indigenous, racialized, whomever, coming together for a collective dream that works for all of us. And as we're starting to wrap up this conversation, I think Shabina touched on this really quite beautifully during the panel.
I grew up in the restaurant industry. My family came over as refugees, and that's kind of where everybody landed, right? And, you know, there's always this dynamic of all the racialized folks who are actually making the food in the back and hiring white waitresses for the front because nobody wants to interact with us, right? you know, and I think for me, that informed my understanding of a lot of the world, right? It's not necessarily what you're doing or how much you know, it's how you present and how people recognize how you say it. And that's the world we live in. That's determined by so many things, white supremacy, even academia at this point, right? I mean, I remember being asked to speak at a conference where people were asking academics to speak about migrant workers. And when we had suggested actually workers who were organizing to come and speak, the answer was no. And that's just the reality, right? And to me, you know, I think in our work at the school, what I've learned is that for a lot of us, this is times of prophecy, right? We're told this is the moment where people from across the world are coming together. And our sacred responsibility is to be able to figure it out. And to me, I can try to beg people to care about people who are brutalized by this system. But the reality is that feels a lot like wasting time. Mm. To me, the responsibility that I have, and I think a lot of people in our courses can relate, is about building a common understanding and respect with one another. You know, there's so much push in terms of being accepted a lot of the time, which I understand, but at the same time, the reality is there's a lot of disdain between our communities for a lot of real reasons. So figuring out how to work with each other and to see where we overlap and, you know, how to build that solidarity is really the important thing for me. And I think to me, it's a lot about humbling and listening and being uncomfortable, but that's how we build a foundation. To me, that's, you know, we're building a course right now on, you know, ethical foraging practices. And so much of that, so much of these conversations are within that around stewardship. Who has the right to steward? Of course, we all do, but where's the hub, the conversation to make that happen amongst different community leaders that have historically been pitted against one another to survive, right? And to me, that's how we build, right? Like, we have so much in common, and that's, you know, we need to build from that.
That was so beautifully put. Yeah, we got to work together. There's no one leader, one hero, one person that's going to save us all from these systems that are deeply entrenched in our society. But we can dream. We can collectively dream. But we don't want to see your dream or hear your dream if it's not centering Black and Indigenous peoples first.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important takeaway, right?
Snap, snap, snap. Yeah. Like you said, we can dream all we want. But if anti-Blackness and anti-Indigeneity, and outside of the context of Canada, there are many Indigenous Black folks, so it's also recognizing that, and even within Canada too. And those are not mutually exclusive, but for the sake of like lingo, anti-Blackness and anti-Indigeneity, like as long as they continue to exist in our midst, all the dreaming will just end up falling flat.
We need good dreams, yo. Yes, we need collective dreams. Well, thank you, Hansel, so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. This is a fun conversation.
It was, right? We got to do this more often.
Yeah. Throw some shade.
A little bit of tea, a little bit of politics, a little bit of food. No, I love it. This is what it's all about. So yeah, thank you for taking the time. So that's it for this episode. Dignity and Joy is a podcast from Future Toronto. We're a food justice organization advocating for the right to food and working to challenge the systemic barriers that keep people from accessing the food they need to thrive. You can learn more about our work at foodshare.net. If you have feedback on the pod, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@foodshare.net or on our social media. We're at foodshareto on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and on Instagram. Hansel, if folks want to learn more about you or see what's up, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me in person and, you know, randomly. Yeah, I'm just kidding. I mean, on Instagram, my first and last name, Hansel Grawa, but I don't be posting, so just find me on other people's Instagram, I would say that. But you can follow me, and when I finally start posting, then you see what I'm up to.
It's a rare occasion, but yeah, you can find them if you can find them. But listeners can also check out the virtual art exhibition around the right to food at realized-reimagined.net. And you can watch the full conversations we also pulled clips from on our YouTube channel. So you can just search for Food Share Toronto.
Big ups to all the speakers, all the people whose clips we use. Lori, Zakaya, Shabina, like everybody, Laura on the podcast, I think. All amazing, powerful, you know, conversations.
Absolutely. I couldn't say that even better. You know, like these are the folks who aren't waiting around for government or anyone else to address the harm that's being done by our food system. They're leading the work right now. So tap into what they're doing. You can find most of their links on FoodShare's website. If you check out the Supportive Partnerships platform tab, we have a lot more information about these folks and their groups. Dignity and Joy is produced in collaboration with Lee Podcasting, with sound engineering and editing by Michael Allen. The production team at FoodShare is Renee D'Souza and Andrea Thompson. Thank you so much for listening.